Hey, Basic Folk Buddies. I want to tell you about a podcast I really love called Broken Record. Each week, hosts Justin Richman and Leah Rose sit down for in-depth conversations with musicians from all kinds of genres and generations. You'll hear artists like Smokey Robinson, Billy Corgan, St. Vincent, Damon Albarn, Daryl Hall, and John Oates, and many more as they open up about their creative lives and the stories behind their most meaningful work. If you're a music fan, I highly recommend checking out Broken Record, where real musicians have real conversations. Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Hi, it's Cindy Howes, and I am the host of this podcast. Today, we are talking to Liv Green. Yes! All right, before we get to Liv, let's do a little bit of housekeeping. Have you signed up for our email list? It's a once-a-month email, comes to your inbox and lets you know what's going on with Basic Folk, who's coming up, who's been on, all our thoughts and feelings. You can sign up for it at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. We're also on social media, at Basic Folk Pod, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. We're also a listener-supported operation, and if you'd like to pitch in a couple of bucks, you can make a monthly donation or a one-time donation. You can go to basicfolk.com, or there is also a donation link in the show notes. I have longed to talk to Liv Green. So every once in a while, you come across a young artist that seems older and wiser than her 26 years. Liv's been giving me that impression since I met her in 2019 when she was at Club Passim waiting tables and breaking hearts on the stage at just 21 years. Okay, all right, I know, enough about being young. Liv's been writing, studying music, and going to music camps since she was 12. Arguably, she's been studying music all her life with her Americana-loving parents who were filling the house with the sounds of Patti Griffin, Emmylou Harris, and Sean Colvin, to name a few. Being the only one of her friends that liked that kind of music, Liv attended many D.C. area concerts with her mom, taking in the magic of live music at a very tender age. And speaking of tenderness, that's what Liv Green is all about, and she digs into it in our conversation. She started writing and playing shortly after she was inspired by a Taylor Swift concert. From there, she took off on the instrument and even sought out music education in camps like Miles of Music in New Hampshire. It was at that camp, as well as the Arts Academy Interlochen High School, where she started meeting peers with similar interests. She found herself living for summers with her music camp friends. Prior to her senior year at Interlochen, Liv was a closeted queer at her all-girls Catholic school, mostly writing fictionalized stories into her songs because she could not deal with who she was. She attended and graduated from the New England Conservatory of Music and released her debut album, produced by Issa Burke, right in time for the pandemic in May of 2020. Shortly after that, she moved to Nashville and has spent the last several years on an intense path of self-discovery. Liv found her community, came out, wrote, and self-produced her new album, Deep Feeler. On this album, you can hear the growth she's experienced, and you can hear Liv thriving in her corner of the Nashville music scene. We talk about all of this, including what it means to have a neurodivergent brain, music production, the roller skating community, and her favorite Taurus personality traits. Let's take a listen to a clip from Liv's new album, Deep Feeler. We're going to check out Wild Geese, and then we'll get to our conversation with Liv Green on Basic Folk.
So you drive like hell, 'cause you stayed up late casting futile spells, singing lullabies that are just love songs for the one that did you wrong. Till your voice was shot and your ears were tired, fearing the same hurt of
Liv Green, what the hell?
Glad to be here.
Okay, I want to start by talking about tenderness. You have the words chronically tender as your social media bio, and your new album is called Deep Feeler. So let's talk about your relationship to tenderness. And also, like, the word chronic has, like, a negative association with it. So I, like, wonder what kind of complex experience you've had with tenderness throughout your life, and, like, where does it land for you now?
Totally. Man, I always knew when I put that as my bio that it would come up time to time. I think tenderness is something that has always kind of been in my nature. I think, like, I'm neurodivergent and I'm the youngest of three girls, so I'm a crybaby, I suppose.
Can I ask you, wait, a quick question. So Lizzie No just texted me the word neurodivergent, like, literally 2 seconds ago, and I've never heard that term before, and now you're saying it again. So can you just give us a definition?
Absolutely. So anyone who's neurodivergent is somebody who is kind of, like, off of the normal spectrum of brains. So, like, anyone who's, like, autistic or ADHD, neurodivergent just kind of refers to people whose brains work a little bit differently in the way that they are wired. So I personally have ADHD, which is something I didn't learn until later in life. And it was so healing, even just, like, diagnosis aside, just that grace I was able to show myself for, like, years of thinking that I was being lazy when really I just really struggled with, like, task initiation and stuff like that. But ADHD is, like, chronically underdiagnosed in women, in particular women and girls, in large part because we tend to, like, internalize our symptoms and feel, like, shame and, like, it's our fault if, you know, we're not up to snuff. And a lot of us are more inattentive rather than, like, so, like, daydreaming type rather than, like, hyperactive. So, like, the kind of two main things that show up for girls with ADHD are hypersensitivity and hypertalkativeness. So I feel like that the tenderness has kind of been hardwired into me from a young age, just in the sense that, like, I've always kind of been a drama queen. I've always felt things really deeply. And I'm maybe hyper romantic as well in that sense, that the daydreaming kind of brain. And then chronically, I mean, I think just kind of came into that point of, like, recognizing that it might be an issue at times. Like, it almost feels like a medical issue that, like, impedes my ability to function a lot of the time. But I own it, and I'm proud of it. I think it's part of why I am the way I am, for better or worse.
When were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed fall of 2022. That was a few years out of college.
That's very recently.
Yeah.
Wow.
Totally. And I had teachers growing up who were, like, telling my parents I should be evaluated. And I struggled really hard. I got really good grades, but through, like, kind of, like, blunt force, like, nose to the grindstone, like, I had to drop the subjects I wasn't naturally either interested or gifted in. It's interesting.
What were you naturally gifted in?
I would say humanities. I'm not a STEM girly. It's never, I'm not good at math. I'm better at the more emotional things. I love history. Mm-hmm. I remember AP US was, like, my favorite course of all in high school. Humanities for sure.
Speaking of someone who loves history, your dad, Philip J. Green.
Oh my gosh, you did your research big time. Not surprised at all, but...
Your dad, Philip Green, is a lawyer, cocktail author. He's written many books on cocktails. He's a cocktail historian. This is what the New Yorker said about him in 2019. By day, he is the trademark and internet counsel for the United States Marine Corps with an office in the Pentagon, and he is as suit and tie proper as the job title would indicate. In his spare time, he is a drinks historian more prone to wearing tuxedos and seersucker. I have so many questions, but this is an interview about you. But what did it look like to have a dad like Philip J. Green? And what is your relationship to drinking because of your dad's interests?
That's a really good question. Man, I never thought I'd be asked about my dad's career in an interview. I think about alcoholism in the sense of like it being genetic a lot when I think about my family, because of the fact that it sounds really bad to say I grew up around alcohol, but I did, in the sense that my dad is like passionate cocktail historian, and no one in my family has really ever had a bad relationship with it. We're very privileged to not have kind of struggled in that sense. So I feel like, yeah, I kind of grew up around just like my dad was a huge cocktail nerd, and discovered that, I guess he was a history major in college and like figured out that one of our ancestors was Antoine Peychaud of Peychaud's Bitters. And that like led him down led him down a whole path of like figuring out basically like the history of the modern cocktail. And he co-founded this like museum in New Orleans for cocktails, and just it was really cool growing up just watching my dad like find his passion, his like real true passion for writing books and for cocktail history, like when he had three young daughters and like had already lived a full life in a sense. So that's always kind of inspired me in the sense that like you can pivot at any point. What was the question again? I'm just kind of rambling about my dad, but
I think you answered it. What your relationship to drinking is because of your dad's interests.
Totally. It's funny. I don't really like drink at all these days. I kind of drink like maybe once a week. I definitely like feel grateful to know a lot of cool recipes because of my dad.
Mm.
Yeah, it's definitely an event, like whenever, like my girlfriend's gonna hang with my family during the holidays a bit this year, and like my dad's always like, what can I make everybody? It's kind of a funny party trick to have a dad who like will just kind of make you whatever drink you want, which is cool.
He's like Lorelai Gilmore's dad.
Not quite that hoity-toit. My dad wrote most of his books in our like basement on a table he found on the side of the road, and it looks terrible. He has like one of those Acer laptops. He like can really clean up well, but like I feel like, yeah, the vibe from that article is a little different than like my dad functionally. He's very like he's pretty like utilitarian, and I don't know.
Have you done a show where your dad is making cocktails based on your songs yet?
I actually did my first of that type in New York at Owl Music Parlor like last December with Brittany Ann Tranbaugh, and he made like a drink named after a song that we recorded together of Brittany's called Christmas Flannel. It was cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
One more question about your dad. So your dad is a public figure.
Yeah.
What did you learn about being a public figure from his experience?
I would say I feel like most of what I learned from my dad's kind of career in cocktails was about like friendships and how that's really most industries like are just friendships at the end of the day. So like we would be traveling and we'd go to a restaurant where he knew the bartender, and then they would hook my parents up with some free drinks or maybe like an appetizer. And that always felt very, very fancy and cool. Like I was like, oh man, free apps or whatever. But just, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the nature of the hospitality industry. I work in restaurants. I've worked in restaurants a lot. I still do. So I feel like just watching that, I mean, I think it kind of parallels with the music industry of just like, we're all in this together, and we list each other for shows, and we, you know, swap CDs, swap t-shirts, shout each other out, play for free in each other's bands. I feel like it's a similar vibe. So just kind of in terms of like having it, I don't like the word network as much, but having like your fabric of your tapestry of friends, and how that is most of the perk of being in any kind of industry is like the people.
All right. We're going to come back to all of those things that we just talked about in just a moment. But first, Taylor Swift. She's an important character in your life. You first saw her when you were 11. You said seeing a young girl play guitar and sing songs that she wrote about her life was really inspiring to me. And that's what caused me to pick up the guitar at 12. Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift is a complex and hugely influential person. So for better or worse, how do you continue to follow and learn from her example?
Yeah, Taylor is one of those figures that like is so activating for people. And I think it, I don't know, I just think it's a waste of energy in a sense. I think that, yeah, I'm really grateful to her and that she inspired like so many women and girls and young people to play guitar and sing. And granted, it's like, I do kind of cringe when I look back at like the, there were so many young girls who like want, we wanted to be her. And so there's a lot of like iPhone or like digital camera photo shoots in the backyard with like a sundress and a guitar. Like it's
Release like, I feel tapes.
Like literally like the girlhood vibes were strong with being a young girl who played guitar and like Taylor Swift. And I think it's been cool to see how she's grown as an artist throughout the years. Nowadays, I feel like she's almost like a different thing in a sense. Like there's like the music industry and then there's like Beyonce and Taylor Swift to me. Like I feel like they're almost like there should be like a separate, like
they're their own industries.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, in terms of her artistry, like later in life, I do feel like a little more critical of her just because of how much resource she has. Just like she could theoretically do anything artistically that she wanted ever. And so there's always this like tinge of extra criticism that I have where I'm just like, ah, this is kind of self-indulgent or yeah, like I'm afraid to say anything actually because I don't want to get Taylor Swift fans mad because I am a Taylor Swift fan, but I do just my relationship with her as I've gotten older and like become a career musician has been a little interesting just because I do feel like she has such opportunity and sometimes I wish she used her platform more for social good and artistically like sometimes I don't totally resonate with all of the 30 songs or whatever that come out in a like release that's like really expansive and has many different versions for you to buy each copy at Target or whatever.
Mm-hmm. She knows how to make money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about going to club shows with your mom. And she would take you because your friends did not want to go to these shows. And some of the shows are 18 plus or 21 plus. So she would have to get permission from the venue to take you into the clubs.
Yeah.
So what were those shows like for you?
Man, those are some of my like most cherished memories as a music lover. I think just because when you're like 15, 16, I feel like those are like the most, it's like almost the most purely you'll ever love music in a sense, or at least like the most formative memories I have with music are like 14, 15, 16. So yeah, my parents and I would like listen to WAMU 105.5, which was like the bluegrass station in DC. And we'd also check out like what would we check out? Just like the calendar for the Birchmere and for like Jam and Java. And we just, or the Barnes at Wolf Trop came a little bit later, but we would just like go to shows. And yeah, my friends wouldn't be interested. I think we went to see the Milk Carton Kids and Etho Donovan and like Gregory Alan Isakov. And I'm trying to think of other shows I went to in high school. Mandolin Orange back when they were, or Watch House back when they were Mandolin Orange. I think that's one in particular I had to be. It was at a venue that's no longer open in Georgetown. And yeah, we had to kind of like message the venue and see if they would like let me go in with my mom. Yeah. And I feel like those were a lot of the shows that made me feel like I wanted to do this for a living. Just because they were tiny venues and these were not household names, but just like the shows that these artists would put on were so, so moving to me. And yeah, I feel like there was just this like reverence for the song that a lot of these spaces had. So yeah, I feel like I just wanted to be doing that as soon as possible after I went to those folk shows with my mom when I was younger.
So you said at one point, when I was younger, I think I felt isolated in my passion, and that was the hardest part. But finding myself in a musical community through camps and festivals really helped me with that and shaped me into the artist that I am. So I have a couple questions about those shows with your mom and then also this new musical community that you've discovered. So like, first of all, what was it like to be the only kid you knew that was into this kind of music?
It was pretty lonely. And I didn't have a ton of friends in high school, like the beginning of high school. I ended up transferring to an arts school my senior year in Northern Michigan. I was super privileged to go to Interlochen Arts Academy up there for a year. But before that, I was in an all-girls Catholic school in Maryland, right outside DC. And the only ways that I could like play music at school, there was no like music program really, was through music ministry. So I was just playing Catholic songs on the guitar.
The Lord.
Yes. Celtic Alleluia. But yeah, I first discovered camps when I was like on the internet looking for an affordable summer camp for music. And the one that I found that was affordable was like for all ages. It was like a fiddle camp, basically, in New Hampshire. It's called Miles of Music Camp and on Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire. And I found it in 2013 on a random Google search. I think it was like the 15th tab or something. Like I was really like looking all over the internet and I found their website. And we didn't know anyone there, but my parents, like, my mom talked to Kristen Andreasen, formerly in the band Uncle Earl, just, like, killer songwriter and musician, on the phone for, like, a couple hours or like, an hour or something.
Couple hours?
My hyperbole is really, really bad. Probably, like, 40 minutes, let's be real. But, like, to me, I just remember it being a really long phone call. And she just assuaged any of my mom's fears. And my mom ended up sending me off to this camp as an unaccompanied 15-year-old minor. And I just learned about old time fiddle music there for the first time, like trad music. And just like learned how to use a pick from a lot of people that I see around town in Nashville nowadays, like Miss Tess and Michaela Ann. Like they were my like early teachers. And yeah, I mean, I just ended up kind of, I feel like I would wait for the summers to see my friends, like my music friends. And then other than that, I would just kind of play alone in my room, and wait for the next summer. I feel like I lived for the summers when I was, in high school.
Yeah. If you are not familiar with Miles of Music, it's a music camp that Kristen Andreasen and Laura Cortese and Dinty Child started on a place called 3 Mile Island on Lake Winnipesaukee. I've been a couple times. It really is life-changing. Mm. Also, what's cool about Miles of Music and Interlochen, the high school in Michigan, is that you are finally meeting kids your own age that are into what you're into.
Oh, yeah, totally. It was magical. Like, yeah, getting to meet kids who like were into music as much as I was or the same kind of music. Yeah, definitely kind of made me feel seen.
I remember talking to Issa Burke about like she came from a really musical family and then going to Maine Fiddle Camp, finally being around people her own age, like playing the same music, she said was like life altering.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember like just staying up like almost all night with my new friends there, jamming just because we like knew a lot of the same songs. We'd just kind of like call songs and play for all hours. Like that's kind of where I took my first guitar solo and learned how to like use a pick and like played with a band for the first time. Like that camp was so formative for me. And like some of those friends are people I still talk to like all the time. Dear friends. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Are you ready to talk about being a gay, a secret gay?
Yeah.
Okay. You went to Catholic school until you were 16 and you were closeted, like we've mentioned. Mm-hmm. You said, I was remarkably depressed. There were only about two other queer kids who were out, both of whom were bullied for it. Mm-hmm. So if you're comfortable with it, can you talk about when you knew you were gay, why you made the choice to hide it, and how did you see it coming out in your writing? Because you started writing when you were 12.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say it's so, yeah. In terms of knowing, like when I knew, it's hard to know just because I feel like it was always kind of an innate thing. It's hard to like know when it clicked. I do know the night that the fear became super big and real. I have a very clear memory of like being, I think it was 2012. I think it was like 14. And I went and saw Brandi Carlile play at Wolf Trap. And she brought her wife, Catherine, on stage at the end. And like, I didn't know like any lesbians growing up at all. Like we were in a really Catholic bubble. And I just kind of didn't have much exposure to queer people. And so just being in a sea of like cool lesbians and then seeing Brandi and her wife, and I admired Brandi so much, especially at that age when I was like new to writing songs. So I remember like that night, like not being able to sleep. It's those moments in life where we have like really hard realizations or like maybe like we get a really bad call of like bad news or whatever, where you remember exactly what you're wearing and what the light looked like and all that. I like remember that night really, really clearly, like the street light coming in on my wall. And just like the agony of like realizing like, ah, I'm pretty sure that I'm gay or at least like queer. And like, I, like that can't be okay. Cause at the time I was like, you know, I went to Catholic school like pretty much my whole life and was taught and had to memorize for tests and to be confirmed and all that, that it's not a sin to be gay, just to act on it. Yay. So great. What a great plan for life. And so, yeah, I just kind of like, and I was so isolated. There was really no one like that around me. So I feel like I remember being like that age after the Brandi Carlile concert, funny enough. And like, I feel like that might've been the night that I pushed it down. And then I find like evidence in journals from high school of being like, I'm still so scared that I'm gay. Yeah, just kind of like it was just so terrifying to me. For a lot of my life, it was just like this like sleeping dragon or whatever that I kind of knew I would have to deal with. Yeah, I don't know if that answered the question, but
that's hard.
Oh, but my writing, how it went into my writing. I feel like I wrote fiction primarily until I kind of came out. Like during the pandemic is when I really accepted my queerness and like saw it as a good thing and like actually like let that weight off and came out to my friends. And I feel like that's when I really started writing more autobiographically. Before then, I really only wrote fiction, with the exception of like one or two songs. And I think part of that was just like not wanting to sit with my own feelings. Yeah. I mean, I think there was like honesty in it, but I think my writing was really like, I really dove into the craft and the storytelling, but I wasn't so much, it wasn't like confessional or like personal by any means.
Hmm. That's so interesting. Like you're perfecting the craft, but you weren't looking at yourself. Okay. We spoke about this musical community that you discovered at Interlochen and Miles of Music Camp. Then you went to the New England Conservatory in Boston. You were in the Club Passim circle, working at the club, playing at the club. Those communities allowed you to fall in with these, like, I don't know, I see them as like the next great generation of folk songwriters that are just like absolutely killing it, like Joby Riccio, Rachel Sumner, Bean, Sadie Gustafson Zook, Grace Givertz. And it really reminds me, I asked Sadie this question during the pandemic, and it might have been like too soon, you know, the pandemic had not ended. But it reminds me of like that group reminds me of those that were like coming up in the Passim circle when I was in college and just after college, like from 2000 to 2010, like Anais Mitchell, Rose Cousins, Deb Talon. So COVID like blew up that scene. Like nobody was able to hang out. No one was able to go to shows or play with each other or write with each other. How did COVID disrupt your musical community?
COVID was so, yeah, I feel very lucky in that I was pretty much done with college. I had like a month left or 2 months left, I guess, when it hit. And I was planning on leaving Boston sort of soon after graduating, but yeah, I mean, I think I was so lucky, especially Club Passim. It's like such an epicenter of like the New England folk scene, and so many artists come through there. Like working there was just like such a masterclass in like playing a listening room, because you got to see so many different artists from all over the country and world come and play. But yeah, I mean, I feel so lucky to have had all my coworkers who were all like songwriters I admired, working at this music venue with me and hanging out in Boston. Like we really had such a sweet little ecosystem. And I feel like the hardest thing about COVID was just not getting to say goodbye to any of it. Like I loved my serving job at Passim, and like Joby and Sadie and Hannah Siglin and all those folks, and Gracie Givertz, and just, yeah, like getting to see them every day and have this little like artistic community. I never really got to say goodbye to it. And it kind of made it so when we all did start building our careers in the more like industrial sense of like tapping into the industry and like trying to like promote our records and tour and like build a fan base, like we all were divorced from the place where we were hoping to launch out of. Like, it was kind of almost like, okay, you're about to jump out of the nest. Like you're building up this momentum. And then like, there's this thing. And it was in a way like a gift. I hate talking about it like this in this sense, in a way, because I lost two grandparents to COVID, and like, it was a really, really hard time, for so many of us. But I was one of the privileged few who was on like unemployment in Massachusetts because Passim was shuttered and I lost my serving job. And so it was kind of a gift of time, in a sense of like, okay, you think you've found yourself and what you have to say, and you're ready to like put out this record and like go for it, and try to have a career, but like, nope, sorry, like it's not going to be what you thought. And I had to sit with myself some more, and I feel really grateful, just because that's when I ended up coming out and really figuring out like what songwriting meant to me, and yeah, figuring out kind of more of what I had to say. So in terms of our community, I think like it's it makes it so that there's a special like kinship to that chapter of our lives because we never got to say goodbye in a sense. So like I just saw Joby and Bean the other night and it felt like we were working at Passim again. Like we could pick up right where we left off. But yeah, it's really just strange to think about all the long-term effects of COVID on the music community more generally. Yeah. It's sad.
So you're talking about releasing your record right around then. That was actually your debut album that you put out in May of 2020, Every yeah. Bright Penny. That was produced by Issa Burke. You wrote the songs in your late teens, recorded them when you were 20 and released it a year after that. So that record is 4 years old and you recently posted for its 4-year anniversary. And you said it definitely feels dated as an album you made when you're 20 ought to. I'm still proud of it and grateful. How do you think you will think about those songs and that version of yourself on its 10-year anniversary? And how do you think about that live now? Maybe start with now and then go in 10 years.
Yeah. I feel like now I look back and I see a really pure songwriter who's like really passionate.
A sweet baby angel.
Yeah. And in a way, I'm like jealous of her innocence in the sense of like, I hadn't quite gotten to a place of self-compassion or self-love. And I'm still trying to get there every day. But I think me being still in the closet functionally, like, was a big kind of sad part of it. And I think, I don't know, I look back and the number one things that I think about are like just my overall kind of style and like embodiment in the way that I sing, the way I dress, like just the general, maybe aesthetic components of it. Like I look back and I'm like, oh, like poor Liv. She like just hadn't quite found herself yet. But I do feel like the songs and the like, I feel like it's very like emblematic of me at that time, like being in Boston. It's got like my Boston community on it. And like one of my friends / mentors, Issa Burke, who's like part of why I, you know, decided to pursue music, like watching her as I was growing up.
Because Issa was also in that Miles of Music camp.
Yeah.
Crew.
Just such a fierce like fiddle player, guitar player, songwriter, person. So yeah, I think looking back now, I'm like, ah, what are you, why are you wearing some weird like Old Navy pirate shirt? And like, what?
I like that shirt. I was looking at that album cover
Thank
today.
You.
I was like, this is a cute top.
I call it my pirate shirt. And I don't have it anymore. But yeah, I think I didn't know how to present myself in a sense. And in a way I'm jealous of the innocence of that Liv just because I wasn't thinking so much about how to package myself. I was just really passionate about the music. But I think 10 years from now, I'd be curious to see how it fares in my experience of it. Yeah, I think it's really kind of crazy. I was 19 when I tracked most of that record. Or no, I was 20. So yeah, I was such a baby. I mean, I really just feel like I feel really, really lucky that it exists and I'm still proud of it. But I do think that like when people talk about the prefrontal cortex or whatever in terms of like when you're 25, I think it might be a myth, but like just the growth that you experience between like 20 and 25 is just so big in terms of your.
Are you 25 yet?
I'm 26.
Whoa. Okay. So you're frontal lobe is totally developed.
Oh, it's totally. I've arrived, really. I have no growing left to do. I know everything now. So
great.
Yeah.
I find, though, as your 20s go on, you are like, I know less and less.
Yeah. I mean, I just know that, I don't know. I just feel like I didn't know myself at all yet then. Not that I like, I feel like I'll be knowing myself for the rest of my life, learning myself for the rest of my life, but there was just such a huge difference in terms of like 20-year-old Liv and like the Liv that I am now. So I'm excited to see like what 30-year-old Liv looking back, I guess 31-year-old Liv at 10 years of the record, what she would have to say about it. I don't know.
We'll check back in.
Yeah.
We'll meet right here. Nashville. You moved to Nashville. I saw Maya DeVitri last night. She played Portland.
Cool.
It was very great. On stage, she said that when she moved to Nashville, people were asking her if she wanted to, like, make it big. And her response was, no, I want to make it small. Which is so, I mean, so great. And then she talked about how she wanted to be your favorite taco truck, but she didn't want to be Chipotle. So anyways,
yeah.
What was your idea or what was your mission when moving to Nashville and how has it shifted since then?
That's a great question. And I love Maya. Oh my gosh, she's one of my heroes, like as a person and as an artist. Yeah, she just always has, she's always like, I think her heart and mind are always like so ahead of the game in terms of just like, I don't know, she's just so, she's so deeply in touch with herself and her craft. But I think when I moved here, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do in music. And I still don't. I think it's changing every day just with how hard this industry is to like make a sustainable living. But I think that I hadn't quite acknowledged how much like the narratives of moving to Nashville and also just like going for it, like were at play in maybe subconsciously at play in like what I wanted. Just because like, yeah, I mean, you dream big. And so, but I do, I was reading something recently. It was like a journal entry that was like goal setting for 2021, which is the year that I moved to Nashville 3 years ago. And most of my goals were like to try producing and like to be part of a really rad community of like queer and women and like just cool artists, and to play in people's bands and to like do my first headline tour. Like they were all things that like I have been doing. So I think that there's like, there are like bigger ambitions that I maybe I'm still trying to like tease out and figure out like what actually matters to me. Cause I think I was talking to my girlfriend about this the other day, just like this idea about like, oh, we're artists. We're like, you know, we're like in the creative industry. Like we kind of take a different path, but it's like, there is a cookie cutter path to it in terms of like what people think. Like, I don't know, if you're like really book smart, like you could be a lawyer or a doctor, like in terms of like the end of the totem pole or the top of the pyramid, the highest earning or whatever, super capitalistically thinking. But like in music, there's a similar, like, as much as we're like, oh, like, you know, it's an alternative life. It's like, there is this like track that people assume that you're on and that you sort of, it's easy to assume that you're on it too. So I feel like the last few years have been a lot of me reckoning with like some of these things that were maybe dreams of mine. And then kind of thinking about like, oh, like it's such a crapshoot. And there's a lot of living in ways that doesn't feel sustainable. It feels like in order to get them. So does that feel right to me? And so I've kind of been, the Liv I am now, like 3 years into Nashville, I feel like wants really different things. And the things that I want are more so like more ideas about my day-to-day life and how I want it to feel more so than like bullet points on the resume or whatever.
Right. Like I want to floss and meditate every day.
or more so like I want to like, I want to like not think about myself and like my streams or like, I don't want to think about all that all the time. Like, I feel like there's so much when you're building a career, it's almost like you're like building, like you have to think about yourself all the time and like how to package stuff and like how things are being received. And I just like, I don't know that that's the job for me sometimes. Like, yeah.
All right, let's talk about this record. Deep Feeler, self-produced sophomore album, along with your collaborator Matt Andrews, and a dreamy band including Basic Folk friends Sarah Jarosz and Elise Levy, and several others. Guys, this is the official arrival of Liv Green as she wants the world to know her. It's awesome. This all sounds very confident, this whole experience, this whole process. How did this album impact your confidence?
Yeah, this album was like really big for my confidence, just in that I really had to bet on myself hard. I partly in producing it myself, but also like, you know, in funding it and working with so many people that I admire, like just it was a lot of like taking chances where I had to kind of rise to the occasion and I maybe didn't have proof of concept yet. So I think it, in a way, I wanted to be my own guinea pig with production. I really like production. It's something that I'm passionate about. And I had been asked by a couple friends before to produce things for them, and I had said no, which is so sad. But also, I hadn't done it before, and I wanted to be my own guinea pig. So it's kind of been, this record's been just like having to believe in myself so much. Almost when like I didn't, I had to like pretend that I did. There were a lot of like studio days where I would like be like, I don't know what I'm doing. I can't do this. And then I would just have to be like, well, you have to. And so I just kind of would go and just like trust myself, trust my ears, trust the people I hired to play the music and to record the music, and just like try to zoom out and be like, okay, like, did we get mandolin tracked? Great. Like, let's move on. Like just learning how to not be so precious and just kind of try and be easier on myself and not so perfectionistic, because I'm a beginner at that. I was a beginner when I made this record, and I had to like really, I'm really grateful to my collaborators for kind of giving me so much patience. And I'm sure there were things that I did that were so silly, just like process got convoluted or something, you know, like, I don't know, that I was learning the whole time, and I felt so safe to do that. And that was such a gift to have gotten to do. So I think my confidence is a lot higher now as like a producer and as a songwriter. I think that, yeah, I feel like these songs have opened a lot of doors for me in terms of like getting to work with people I really admire. And so I'm just excited to make another one soon and to get out there and like play these songs, just because like some of them are as old as like 4 years old. So it'll feel really, really good to like get to, now that they're the world's, or next month they'll be the world's and not just mine. I'm excited to like see how they land and how people connect with them if they do.
If you are listening right now on the day this episode is released, Liv's album comes out tomorrow. And if you're listening anytime after that, the album's out, Deep Feeler. Can you talk more about like how your writing feels to you now that you're like fully on board with yourself?
I would say my writing now feels like, it feels more of like a meditative in a sense. Like I, even when it's not factually autobiographical, I think that there's an element of like openness to my feelings that I have been fostering over the last few years, even when they're ugly feelings. So yeah, I think my writing now is, and hopefully becoming ever more like observant of the world around me, but also just like my own genuine internal landscape in regards to like what I'm going through, which is something that maybe was really scary for me in the past. So yeah, I'd say just observant. I hope that I continue to kind of try and be paying more attention in my writing to like the feelings and maybe like putting them under a microscope and like just, yeah, thinking like turning them over and holding them a little bit longer. I think writing is my favorite way to kind of sit with myself. And I know when I'm not writing, like when I'm most depressed is usually when I'm not writing. And I think that they do kind of go hand in hand. So it is kind of a selfish act in that sense.
Selfish for us too, because we directly benefit. Okay.
Thank you.
We'll do the lightning round, but we've got one more question.
Yeah.
Liv Green, what is your roller skating story?
I'm so glad you asked. It's funny. I got into it during the pandemic, like so many others. And it was like the week that my partner of 3.5 years and I had broken up or ended. And it was kind of like, there's a song on the album called Flowers that's like about self-love purchases. And I think it's really ironic that I didn't include roller skating because that was probably the biggest investment in myself after the breakup in terms of just like something that I always wanted to do. It's like the bad self-portraits by Lake Street Dive effect of like being single and being like, I'm going to invest in a hobby. Yeah, I got them during the pandemic in like fall of 2020. And I would take them down to this like church parking lot down the street from my house in Brighton, Mass. And eventually they put up signs that were like, no loitering. I think because I went there.
No loitering, Liv Green.
Because I went there like every day. It was this Catholic church down the street, their parking lot. And I was like, you guys owe me.
You're like, yeah, you owe me. I'm in this club.
Yeah, reparations for the queer pain. Just the, let me use the space for in exchange for all the pain that the Catholic Church caused me. But I just would skate in the parking lot. And then, yeah, it just became like a true joy for me. When I moved to Nashville, I found the Greenway here. And it's like, I think my favorite way to exercise is just like skating. It's like, it's just like there's adrenaline involved, which is fun, but a healthy amount of risk. Like, it's not a motorcycle. I think that I like I'm a thrill seeking person. So like going down a slight hill on skates feels really, really good. But it's, I do wear my wrist guards. So that's, yeah.
Well, you got to protect the money makers.
Oh, yeah. So much money. Woo! Woo!
All right. Let's do the lightning round.
Yeah.
First question. What are you wearing to the Taylor Swift concert?
Ooh, like if I were to go to one.
Mm-hmm.
Glitter. Something sparkly. And some boots. Fearless Era vibes.
Okay. What is your favorite roller skating accessory?
A dad hat. I should wear a helmet, but I wear wrist guards, but I wear a dad hat.
Okay. Protect that moneymaker.
I should.
What is your favorite Nashville treat or snack?
The Crunchwrap from the Beehive Vegan Deli. It's like the Taco Bell Crunchwrap, but it's vegan.
Cool.
It's really good.
What is your favorite cocktail that you can make?
Recently, espresso martinis.
Oh, all right. I'll be right over. Thank you.
Yeah, come on over.
three more. What is your favorite Patty Griffin album?
Living with Ghosts.
Yeah, that's the correct answer. Thank you.
Yes.
What is your favorite thing about being a Taurus?
The food. I think Tauruses love food in my personal interpretation. We love earth. We love creature comforts. Food. Big fan.
This is the last one. It's a fun one. Who is your historical queer crush?
That's a great question. I mean, this isn't that historical, so I don't know if it counts. But Mary Oliver.
Okay.
Who's a queer poet. She died in like 2012, so I don't know if that counts.
Fairly historical.
Yeah. I don't know if I have an answer for the lightning round.
Nope. We'll take Mary Oliver.
Mary Oliver.
Come on.
I mean, gosh, just the most beautiful stuff ever. Her poems. So mm-hmm. beautiful.
No big deal.
Yeah. Dreamy. Dreamboat.
All right, Liv. This was great.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it so much.
I appreciate you. I'm such a fan of the pod, so I'm glad we finally got to do this.
Hell yes, we fucking did it.
Yeah!
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Check us out on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Go to our website, basicfolk.com, or wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. That is the best way for Basic Folk to grow and reach new listeners. If I were you, Cindy, I'm speaking to me in the future, I would send this episode to our friend Rose Cousins, because don't you think Rose Cousins and Liv Green need to know each other? All right, I'm going to send this episode to Rose Cousins. You send it to your Rose Cousins, and we'll call it a day. All right, thanks for listening all the way to the end. Bye.